Another day, another big economic policy speech. What she said and what it means. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday, the 11th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Purists on either side of the political aisle are not going to want to hear this. But there are a couple of points on which Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump agree. I know, but hear me out. The American economy, they both say, needs some oomph. How to get there is where they differ. Among many other specifics she cited in her speech today, Secretary Clinton said this.
And Wall Street corporations and the super rich should finally pay their fair share of taxes. That's why
new tax revenue coming in, new government spending on infrastructure and jobs. Classic, in the word of economists, fiscal stimulus. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going.
Free college for middle-class kids, major infrastructure programs, broadband for all, new scientific research. That's some of what Clinton said today would be her spending priorities. But for all that, she'll need more money in the government bank account. How she'll get the money?
We will fight for a more progressive, more patriotic tax code that puts American jobs first.
Clinton says she'll tax corporations that take jobs outside of the country, plus make them pay back any tax credits or incentives they had in the past. She wants a new tax on multimillionaires and to close tax loopholes. Don Grimes is an economic researcher at the University of Michigan. He says the point is to
sort of tilt the incentives towards investment activity as opposed to consumption activity.
And remember, says Gene Sturley of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center, the government isn't starting from a blank slate here. We've already got a balance sheet pretty out of whack, and new policies have to consider our massive debt and deficit.
There's this bigger budget issue that's looming over everything, and if you can't get the budget in some ways to start at least being sustainable, then all of this is going to be pretty small stuff.
To balance the budget or change any tax policy, you need Congress. And getting major change through there is, let's just say, a challenge. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
As Kimberly alluded to, one way to think about fiscal stimulus is that it's what politicians do. The other way to poke the economy is what's called monetary policy, what the Fed and central banks around the world do. There are questions, though, in these oh-so-unusual economic times about just how much more oomph central bankers have left in them. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that slice of this story from New York.
Central banks have tried everything in the toolbox to promote economic growth, and they're even making up whole new toolboxes, but they're not consistently getting big results, says Steve Blitz, chief economist at M Science.
We're now beyond the point of where monetary policy in and of itself can work.
Take one of the measures currently in vogue in Japan and Europe, negative interest rates. The idea sounds a bit bizarre and is a little tricky to understand, but the aim is really simple. Get the economy moving by making borrowing and spending more attractive than saving. The thing is, in Japan and some European countries, data point to people saving more. Sarah Johnson of IHS Global Insight thinks she may know why.
The general state of the economy, the lack of confidence, are what's driving the rise in saving rates.
The same gloomy economic outlook that is moving policymakers to try unusual things seems to also be spurring people to stash money away in case things get worse. There's a growing consensus that central banks have been taking too much of the burden of supporting the economy, says Paul Sheard, chief global economist for S&P Global.
Central banks really have reached the point where they really, I think, legitimately can throw the ball back to the government and say, look, we've done our bit here.
That, of course, presumes politicians actually doing things, never a safe bet. But those low, low interest rates we keep talking about could help nudge them to action. Jonathan Parker is a finance professor at MIT's business school.
When interest rates are extremely low, then government spending is relatively cheap. And so that suggests that it's a good time to do things that you think you have to do at some point.
So it may be the case that the monetary policy squashing interest rates could make fiscal policy a little more attractive. Central banks could probably use the break. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Fiscal, schmiscal, monetary, schmonetary. Wall Street was fat, dumb, and happy today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. No policy speech would be complete in this day and age without a nod to climate change. Hillary Clinton obliged today.
Some country is going to be the clean energy superpower of the 21st century and create millions of jobs and businesses. It's probably going to be either China, Germany, or America. I want it to be us.
In the solar category of clean energy, solar cells are getting cheaper. Tax credits and incentives are making them more popular as well. California leads in solar installation going away, and more is on the way, in part because in some places out here, it is the law of the land. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim has that story.
For Mark Smith, owner of Solar Forward, installing a solar rooftop isn't just a matter of slapping panels on top of a house. Smith shows me some of the panels he's testing up on his own roof in the city of Santa Monica.
You have to consider the shading. You have to consider the slope of the roof. You have to consider the direction of the roof. So we take a lot of things into account when we design a solar system.
Solar Forward has installed hundreds of systems across Southern California. Smith's first project was on his own house, which he built without solar power in mind. His roof was oriented all wrong.
I had to add a roof plane that was large enough and facing the right direction to build my solar system.
From now on, new roofs in Santa Monica are going to have to be designed with solar in mind. That's because of a new law that says all new construction projects in the city must have a solar rooftop. I met up with Dean Kubani, Chief Sustainability Officer for Santa Monica, the day the law went into effect.
We, like a lot of other cities, are looking at greenhouse gas impacts and carbon impacts, and we're trying to figure out how can we become carbon neutral.
Santa Monica generates about 4.5 megawatts of power from solar, enough to power about 1,000 homes. How much more the new requirement will add is unclear. There isn't a lot of undeveloped land in Santa Monica. Still, the market is booming.
People are buying old buildings, knocking them down, and building new ones.
Santa Monica is not the first city in California to make this kind of solar mandate. That distinction goes to Lancaster, about 1.5 hours north of Los Angeles.
We were the first in California by, I think, 30 days.
Brian Ludicky is the planning director for the city of Lancaster. Its mandate began in 2014.
What we've learned is it's been a pretty positive experience. I really have not heard of any significant downsides from the requirement to place solar on new housing.
Ludicky says solar is a natural fit for Lancaster. Unlike cool coastal Santa Monica, Lancaster sits in the Mojave Desert. There's lots of sun from which to get energy. With that, lots of air conditioning needed.
Thanks so much.
Brandy Town bought her house before the mandate went into effect. Even so, her family still sprang for solar panels.
We were paying $260 a month for the electric. In the summer months, it was between $400 and $700 a month.
Now it's about $8 a month. Solar panels are all over Lancaster. Stop signs even have them to power their blinking red LEDs. So more than 2 years in, what lessons learned can Lancaster offer Santa Monica? Lancaster City Planner Chun Ng.
I think each community is different. The housing market's different. The housing products are different. So I think they'll find their own set of unique challenges.
Just like each roof has its own considerations when it comes to solar. Santa Monica has less sun, Lancaster has more space, but a weaker housing market. Lately, it's only averaged about 100 home permits a year. And San Francisco, which next year becomes the first major American city to require solar, doesn't that have a lot of fog? I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
There was some stump speech boilerplate from Secretary Clinton today, stuff we have heard before.
While corporate profits are at near record highs, paychecks for most people have barely budged. Incomes aren't growing fast enough to keep up with the costs of living, like prescription drugs and child care.
Not all corporate profits are up. I should clarify here, Macy's for just one. The company announced this morning it's closing 100 stores, almost 15% of them, after another quarter of falling profits. Other giant retailers have done the same thing of late, brick and mortar trying to keep up in an era where you don't even have to leave your couch to go shopping. Here's Sally Herships.
When it comes to retail, Macy's is like that couch in the living room at your mom's. You don't even really see it anymore. It's always there. Except soon, it won't be at 100 locations across the country. But do not go blaming the internet.
85% of purchasing happens in a brick-and-mortar environment.
Steve Goldberg is with the Grayson Company, a retail consulting firm. He says the real problem is
the American retail landscape has got far too many stores.
He says retail is bloated, or as the industry says, we are overstored. So how do companies figure out which stores to keep and which to toss overboard? Location plays a big part. Remember the mall? Josh Pollack is with retail consulting firm Parker Avery.
There are quite a few malls in the U.S. that used to be in very good locations, or at least in reasonable locations.
But then population shrank or consumers with less money moved in.
And they're just no longer good locations.
But it's complicated. Steve Goldberg again.
Online and offline stores today have this sort of chemical interaction. Customers want to see product physically, and then they'll go and order it online.
Goldberg says when you close a physical store, online sales in the same geographic area suffer. He says retailers need physical stores, but to make them a success, they need to focus on customer experience, be it bargain hunting or visiting a classic American brand like Macy's. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
As did Mr. Trump on Monday, Secretary Clinton gave China a poke or two today.
It is also true that China and other countries have gamed the system for too long. Enforcement, particularly during the Bush administration, has been too lax.
That was about trade specifically, but China is in the news this week for something else as well. Beijing has long been wary of GMOs. It allows imports of genetically modified corn and soybeans for animal feed over there, not for domestic production. But this week, in its new five-year plan for science and technology, Beijing said it's going to allow the commercialization of biotech corn and soybeans over the next couple of years. Seeing as how it's a global economy and a global marketplace, Annie Baxter has that story.
China's population is growing, and so is its middle class. That means more people eating meat and more imports of corn and soybeans for animal feed.
And this step to commercialize GMOs is really an attempt by them to limit the amount of growth in imports that they will have to do in the future.
That's Bruce Babcock, an ag economist at Iowa State University. He says biotechnology could help farmers in China increase yields and make them less vulnerable to climate change with drought-resistant crops. Babcock says it's not immediately clear if China's push to commercialize genetically modified corn and soybeans will be bad for U.S. corn and soybean producers. China is U.S. soybean farmers' biggest market.
We could have another drought in the United States. South America could have a big drought. Today's abundance could turn around quickly. And so in 3 to 5 years, the world might actually welcome increased production of corn and soybeans from China.
And Philippe de la Perouse at HighQuest Partners says infrastructure issues in China could still make imports desirable.
In some cases, it's cheaper for them to source beans from Brazil and the U.S. than it is within China itself, simply because it's more efficient to ship in large Panamaxes from the U.S., Brazil, and Argentina, as opposed to moving a product domestically.
And De La Perouse says China's move towards genetically modified crops could lower the political barriers to exporters trying to get GMO crops approved there. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So they sell their fishing boats, they buy a fleet of motorcycles or a shack on the beach, and they set up shop.
Job retraining is sort of what that is. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 117 points, 2/3% today, 18,613. The NASDAQ up 23 points, 0.4%, 5228. The S&P 500 up 10 points, 0.4%, 2185 at the close. And oh, by the by, record highs, all of them. Macy's up 17% after that announcement. It's closing all those stores. Rival Kohl's up 16.1%. Nordstrom up about 7.5% today. Some of the nation's largest shopping center owners got mauled, though. General Growth Properties down 3.4%. Kimco Realty and the Simon Property Group both gave up 2% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.56%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. In a world of fiscal policy proposals, infrastructure spending always looms large, as Kimberly Adams touched on up at the top of the broadcast. And indeed, Secretary Clinton checked that box today.
We will put Americans to work, building and modernizing our roads, our bridges, our tunnels, our railways, our ports, our airports.
Once you get the airport terminals and the runways built, though, you got to get people on the planes. And if you remember at the start of this summer's travel season, long, long security lines were the watchword. The TSA did respond. Lines are shorter. But during the great long line debacle of 2016, some airports started looking into privatizing security, replacing TSA workers with contractors. To get a sense of what that might look like, Sam Harnett went to an airport that privatized its security years ago.
This is me in line at SFO in San Francisco. As you can hear, as usual, I'm having a great time reorganizing all my stuff for security. San Francisco is one of 21 airports with privatized security. And you would not believe how completely, totally, entirely the same it feels and looks like any other airport.
You're going to see a ticket checker at the entrance to a security checkpoint, making sure that you've got the right documents. You've got a
Doug Yackel is SFO's PIO, Public Information Officer.
You'll see the row of tubs for divesting items, for screening.
The little gray tubs. What would an airport be without them? Here's the deal with privatized security. TSA is still in charge. It picks and manages the contractor that then has to follow TSA protocols. Like, I still have to dump, or divest, everything into those little gray tubs. Privatizing is not about escaping TSA, but managing labor, says Brian Springer. He's director of Montana's Bozeman Yellowstone Airport. Like most airports with privatized security, it's tiny. A few delayed planes can throw everything out of whack. Springer believes contractors can deliver a more flexible workforce. And it's easier to fire people.
If employees are not performing, they can be dealt with appropriately better or more effectively on a contract side than a government side.
Labor unions say the real reason airports want to go with contractors is simple: to cut costs. James Mudrock heads the union representing TSA workers in Sacramento, California.
We believe that national security should be a federal government operation and not turned over to private for-profit companies.
When long lines hit this summer, the discussion wasn't about labor or national security. It was about wait times. Airports like SeaTac in Washington and Phoenix Sky Harbor in Arizona said they were investigating privatizing security. Well, it's been a few months, and no airport has done it. Ian Redhead is not surprised.
Some people don't know all of the ramifications of a private screening contractor.
Redhead is deputy director of the Kansas City International Airport, which does have privatized security. Redhead says it comes with some risks. Unlike the TSA, contractors can fall through. Redhead just had to replace his, which has been disruptive.
Yes, the newer contractor is still trying to get up to speed.
The TSA says it's found no difference in performance between federal workers and contractors. What would really help long lines is if Congress stopped siphoning off money from the TSA, says Christopher Bidwell. He's with the Airports Council International, an advocacy group for airports.
Because TSA is underfunded, basically, the void has been filled on a voluntary and temporary basis by airports and airlines as well.
You see, every passenger pays a roughly $11 round-trip security fee. Bidwell says since 2014, Congress has been redirecting a third of that money, which adds up to over $1 billion a year. And since 2013, TSA has had to lay off around 10% of its staff. Bidwell says there just aren't enough workers, public or private. Until that changes, he says, many long lines await. Oh, joy.
Please make sure you have all your personal belongings and watch your tray.
In line to fly out of San Francisco, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
One of the great things about political speeches, Secretary Clinton's today specifically, but all of them really, because they have to give these speeches hundreds and hundreds of times, is that there is a certain amount of one-size-fits-all to them. An infrastructure passage here, a tax policy paragraph there, and today from Mrs. Clinton, this bit on jobs.
And for too long, big promises about the power of training and retraining haven't delivered like they should. It doesn't help anybody to be trained for a job that doesn't exist.
Job retraining has been big here for a while now, but it applies in the rest of the global economy as well. India, for our purposes today. Samant Subramanian traveled along the coast of that country looking at the history and the economy of the fish industry for his book. It's called Following Fish. We got him on the phone from New Delhi. Samant, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai.
You start this book, this voyage, I suppose, on the East Coast, up in the corner by Bangladesh in Kolkata and in Bengal. You work down to the sort of tip, the bottom of India. You work your way back up the other side, the West Coast, and you wind up almost at the end in Goa,
mm-hmm.
On the West Coast of India. And there's a great quote about the economy in Goa and how it relates to how they get by there. And you say, Goa is an economy of idleness, not an economy made up of idle people, but an economy that relies on the human desire to idle. It's a commentary on tourism and what happens in an economy, yeah?
That's true. I mean, it's very much part of sort of the spirit of Goa itself. I mean, idleness is the linchpin of the tourist economy, as you rightly point out. But as a corollary, it is also a state made up of people who are happy to let life slip past, even as they live, you know, decade after decade in Goa on the beach or next to the beach. And it's very palpable. I mean, you know, the notion of time itself is so fluid. Punctuality, for example, is not a pressing concern.
and this is a place, we should say, where traditional fishing, the industry there, has been replaced by tourism, by these people coming to be idle.
The traditional fishing community was, you know, it sort of found itself out of a job just because of the advent of large mechanized trawlers that took their place, essentially. I mean, these trawlers fish all the year round. They take in such large catches that for what might in Brooklyn be called the artisanal fisherman, there's really not much to do. These fishermen find themselves out of work, and the only other industry in Goa to which they can turn is the tourism industry. So they sell their fishing boats, they buy a fleet of motorcycles or a shack on the beach, and they set up shop. And from the comfort of our homes, we can bemoan the loss of traditional fishing, but it's very difficult to put ourselves in their shoes and kind of think about what we would do when it really is a question of economic survival.
There is also, and I confess to be coming at this from an outsider's perspective, there is also an element of the caste system that is reflected in the fish economy, if that's not too much of an oversimplification.
I mean, that's true. India, you know, outlawed the caste system in 1947 when it became independent, but it's very difficult to sort of remove every vestige of it entirely, and people often are engaged in the sort of professions that their caste prescribes them to be engaged in. And part of my motivation for writing this book was to actually explore those communities and their histories and their particular cultures a little bit.
Yeah. Before I let you go, you spent, I don't even know how much time on the road, eating your way, I imagine, around India. What was the best thing you had to eat? What was the best dish?
Yeah, I write about this in the book, actually. I go to a town called Mangalore and seek sort of the perfect Mangalore fish curry, which is really a curry that is known well across the length and breadth of India, but I really wanted to taste it in a classic Mangalore home. And I do get to do that. I mean, the chapter ends with sort of a cook taking me into her kitchen under her wing and making this curry for me right in front of my eyes. I fall a little bit in love with the cook. It's all very complicated, but the dish comes out exquisite.
It's a book called Following Fish by Samant Subramanian. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
That recipe he mentioned, we've got it for you, marketplace.org. Give it a whack. Let us know what you think. This final note on the way out today, there was a whole long section on trade in Secretary Clinton's speech today, comparing and contrasting her approach with that of her opponent. They do, however, agree on at least one thing trade-related. Here is Secretary Clinton today.
I will stop any trade deal that kills jobs or holds down wages, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
It bears a mention here because context is important that Mrs. Clinton was for the TPP before she was against it, calling it at one point the gold standard of trade agreements. Record-setting day on Wall Street today. The Dow up 117 points, 2/3%. The Nasdaq up 23 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 up 10 points, 0.4% there. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.